Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The stories keep coming out of Flint, Michigan. As many as 8,000 children under age 6 exposed to unsafe levels of lead. Corroded pipes, a lagging official response, and children who could suffer lifelong neurological damage. But Flint is actually only part of the story of lead in America. Lead is everywhere, in all 50 states, in water, paint, soil, and more, with children often suffering higher levels than in Flint. This hour on Point, the threat of lead, way beyond Flint, Michigan. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know if there is lead in your water, in your home? Have you seen the neurological damage it can cause? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Let's go first today to Flint, Michigan for a moment. Steve Carmody is with us, Flint reporter for Michigan Radio. He's been closely watching developments there. Steve Carmody, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Does Flint have a plan for cleaning up the crisis we've all seen?
There's a plan slowly developing. When we first confirmed that there was lead in the drinking water in town, that was about 6 months ago. And even though we've known that the main source of the lead in the drinking water came from transmission lines, from city water mains to people's homes, no pipes have actually been dug up yet. We won't get our first pipe actually out of the ground until next week. And at this point, it may just be one pipe that they're going to take out. There's no plan in place at the moment to completely remove the up to 15,000 lead line transmission lines that need to be removed.
So are people in Flint still drinking bottled water? Is everybody still dependent on water from outside?
Absolutely. There is a state effort to deliver water to distribution centers at fire stations around the city. There are also individuals and organizations bringing water in from other parts of the country. And people are relying on bottled water, and they're also relying on special filters that have been brought in that screen out the lead. But those filters are only certified up to about 15 parts per billion, which is the federal action level for lead in water. And in some cases, we have homes with 4,000 or 5,000 parts per billion in the water. And while the EPA at this point is saying the filters still work even at those high levels, people are not 100% sure that they can trust the filters yet.
Are people bathing and washing dishes in this water?
They have been for the entire time that this has been going on. This actually dates back to when the city switched from its original water source to the Flint River back in April of 2014, and problems started back then. People have, over time, been trying to get away from their use of water, which, if you think about your own use, water is a big part of your day, from bathing to drinking to making food. And, you know, I talk to people all the time who literally will boil water in, you know, large pots and put it in a bathtub, and that's how they wash their kids, and that's how they wash themselves.
First pipe not out of the ground until next week, Steve Carmody is telling us. There was a press conference in Flint yesterday. Of course, I know you saw this, Steve. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder was there talking about the steps involved in getting the lead out of Flint's drinking water.
The ultimate goal here needs to be replacing the lead service lines. There's a number of steps to do that, and one of those steps is to get an infrastructure study done. We need to understand where the lead service lines are, to take them out and to have them replaced. We think there's approximately 10,000 service lines. We don't know their composition that are connected to active residences, and we want to find out that information as best as possible.
Meanwhile, people not feeling closely cared for there. Sandra Weston, longtime resident of Flint, talked with NPR's Ari Shapiro just last week, saying the whole thing has kind of destroyed her faith in government officials.
The people we trusted failed us. It's not us who failed them. They failed us. We are the expendables. It feels like it. We are expendable.
Steve Carmody in Flint, who's going to pay to fix all this lead pipe in Flint?
Well, it can't be the city of Flint. The city is in very dire financial straits. It only just came out of out from under complete state control. It still has an oversight board appointed by the governor to manage, oversee the city's operations. But the city doesn't have the $55 million that the mayor says is what is needed minimally just to replace the lead pipes, not to take care of the entire problem. They're looking to the state and the federal government for help. The state has about a $25 million appropriation that's currently in the legislative process, but that hasn't been approved yet, and no word yet as to whether any money will be coming from the federal government to cover the cost of removing these lead lines.
Wow, what a picture. Steve Carmody with Michigan Radio in Flint, Michigan. We'll be following your reporting, and we're really grateful to you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Lots of conversation about Flint nationally on Monday. Bernie Sanders had a rally in Ypsilanti, Michigan, not far from Flint, met with residents of Flint, said he couldn't understand how lead could still be such a problem in 2016.
It is beyond my comprehension that in the year 2016, in the United States of America, we are poisoning our children.
And Hillary Clinton was in Harlem on Tuesday talking with residents about Flint, saying, look, it's not just Flint, not just Michigan.
Flint is not alone. There are many Flints across our country, places where people of color and the poor have been left out and left behind.
And we're hearing about plenty of those. Here's a little tape from last month in the town of Sebring, Ohio, at a council meeting to talk about the discovery of lead in the drinking water there. Environment officials said residents were not notified for months that unsafe levels of lead had been found. Here's one Sebring resident concerned for the families in the community.
A lot of us have kids at home. We're extremely afraid, and we need a mayor to stand up, be honest with us, hold people accountable, and fix this problem.
You've got people all over this country who really know this problem, watching the uproar over Flint and thinking, well, it's not just there. One of them is with me in the studio right now, Dr. Moitre Mazumdar, pediatric neurologist at Boston Children's Hospital, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. She has been very up close and personal with this issue for a long time. Moitre Mazumdar, Dr. Mazumdar, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
When you see the reports out of Flint and you think about your own work in your own community, what goes through your mind?
Well, I'm shocked, really, to see what's happened in Flint, and but at the same time, not incredibly surprised. We know in the medical and public health community that lead really is still everywhere in every state in the country. Certainly in Massachusetts and where I practice at Boston Children's Hospital, we see children who have lead levels the same as those that have been found in Flint, among children in Flint, but also with levels that are much higher. Children are still being poisoned with lead all over the country.
Much higher than Flint. So what's the kind of level that you saw reporting out of children who were drinking the water there? How does it compare with the kind of lead levels you're seeing in your own community?
So the my understanding of what brought this to the attention of the country and the world was that there was increased levels in Flint, that an increased number, increased percentage of children that had crossed this, were found to be above this reference level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, which is currently the reference level that's used in the United States to identify children who have higher levels of lead.
5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of drinking
blood,
water.
Of blood.
So that's like someone told me like a flake of flour in a Dixie cup of blood.
Something like that. And we know that that level and even levels below that are associated with neurologic injury and poor performance, academic performance, attention problems, many neurologic problems. In Boston, in Massachusetts, in in places all over the country, there are children with levels that are orders of magnitude higher than that, you know, in the 40s and 50s. Not many, but still an unacceptable number water as much as paint, we think, in old and deteriorating housing.
Describe the impact of lead on a child if they get into those kind of numbers, above 5 or above 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or even 50, as you describe it. What's the range of impacts on development, behavior, future?
Well, this is something that we know very well. We've been dealing with lead for decades in this country. And in the 70s, when the average level was around 15. We certainly saw kids in the hospital who would present with seizures, would present with coma even, at levels at 60s and 70s micrograms per deciliter. And as we've been successful, and this public health effort has actually been incredibly successful in lowering lead levels, we don't see that as often. These children who are presenting with seizures, with coma, with devastating neurologic injury that persists. But as the levels have lowered, we've learned that there still are neurologic consequences, that children who have lower levels of lead in their blood still perform worse in school. They perform worse in academic testing. And so we're seeing that even at these lower levels, that there are neurologic consequences to children.
I'm reading here changes in the brain from lead exposure, mm-hmm. subtle, permanent, and devastating, robbing them of parts of the brain that enable people to pay attention, to regulate emotions, to control impulses.
All of those things have been seen in studies of children who are exposed to lead. You know, in childhood, that's a period of time where the brain is making very important connections that help them develop cognitively, help them understand their environment, their behavior, and all of these systems can be disrupted, have been shown to be disrupted by lead exposure.
Are they disrupting, it's clearly individual children, are they disrupting whole communities of children?
Yes. I mean, we certainly know that certainly now the burden of lead exposure is in certain communities in the United States. And
you've said, where's the moral outrage? Because the problem is much wider than Flint.
Right. The problem is much wider than Flint. And more than that, it's known. We've known this for decades.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the threat of lead way beyond Flint, Michigan. Lead rates as high and higher in many parts of this country and what to do about it. You can join us this hour. Have you been shocked by the news out of Flint? Are there higher levels of lead in your own backyard? Do you even know? Have you been told your child has too much lead in his or her blood? And doctors, teachers, do you see the evidence of lead poisoning effects in the children in your care? There was a time when lead was all over the place, poured into lots and lots of products, gasoline, of course, and paint right at the head of the list, but not only there, and it was celebrated. Here's the Bureau of Mines made a film in 1948 promoting the lead industry in Missouri's Lead Belt, and here's a little bit of that film. They talk about some of the many products that use wonderful lead.
Almost every car uses lead in storage batteries, solder and bearing metals, and even in brake linings. Lead is used in gasoline for better performance. And humble lead also plays its part in preserving and protecting old and new buildings. Such is the story of an American mining community.
Humble lead, once celebrated, now feared. Yesterday, California Governor Jerry Brown asked the California legislature for $176 million to clean up the dangerous levels of lead left in soil by the Exide battery recycling plant outside of Los Angeles. Amelia Vallejo lives in a mile from the plant. Her soil tested positive for lead at levels way above California's standard for toxic waste. Her kids have shown signs of lead poisoning. She talked with CBS News yesterday.
Before my kids would play on the ground, they would roll over on the grass. I didn't know I was harming my kids.
I feel like my whole family's been taking advantage, but yet we're not getting the proper help. It's taking quite a bit of time. And once again, the damage has been done.
It's out there. There's a lot of it. It's not just Flint, Michigan, and its presence falls most heavily in poorer communities. Dr. Moitre Mazumdar is with us from Harvard Medical School and Boston Children's Hospital. Also with us right now from Washington is Eric Olson, director of the Health and Environment Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's senior strategic director of the Food and Health Program. Eric Olson, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
If you could paint a map of the United States and where lead concentration is most acute and dangerous, what would it look like?
Well, I wish I could say that it was limited to certain areas, but certainly it occurs in all 50 states. We've got older housing stock where we have serious lead contamination problems, especially in some of the older cities and where there are pockets of poorly maintained housing. But we also have these lead service lines. These are the pipes that go from your street into your home or into an apartment building. Mm-hmm. There are millions of them across the country. In fact, a lot of people don't realize this, but the word plumbing comes from lead. You may remember your periodic table when you were in high school. The symbol for lead is PB, plumbing.
Yeah.
That's where the word comes from. It was widely used, and it wasn't even banned until the 1980s.
Lead was in gas. Lead was in paint. When did it come out?
Well, it came out of the paint in the 70s. It came out of gas in the 80s. It came out of plumbing in the 80s and 90s. And frankly, until pretty recently, it could still be used in things like faucets. And it was called, quote, lead-free in faucets and plumbing fixtures and so on under an act of Congress until very recently if it had up to 8% lead.
I remember as a kid, back on the farm, we had our own gas tank and pump there to fill up tractors. That would have been fully leaded gas. I loved the fumes. They smelled great. Can you kill off brain cells just by breathing that stuff?
Well, absolutely. And the average blood lead levels back in those days when there was leaded gasoline were much higher than they are now. But, of course, the highest levels are likely to be in kids that are living in substandard housing that has a lot of peeling and flaking and lead dust from the paint, and also obviously in communities where you have these lead service lines and corrosive water. Those are going to be where you see some of the bigger problems. And of course, around something like a lead smelter or a hazardous waste dump that has a lot of lead near it.
Dr. Mazumdar with me in the studio. Flint has put all the attention on water, but of course, it's those that paint and chips, even now, decades after the time when it was widely used, that's still getting to kids, getting into kids.
It's still getting to kids and to a lot of kids. The CDC estimates, and you know that they do estimates that more than 500,000 children in the United States have lead levels above 5 of the current level of concern, a level that's been shown to be associated with neurologic injury. And
though they're saying now that any level is too much,
right, and this level is important to understand that previously we used to have thresholds for levels, for lead levels, where we would say above this level is what you're concerned about, and then below this level is thought to be safe. But now we really think that there's no level of lead that's safe. And this 5 is used to stratify risk and to identify children who need more intervention.
So,
but a half a million children.
Half a million above that level and even below that level, it's there and it's dangerous. John in Sebring, Ohio, that's a name we know from this problem. Sebring, there's been lead discovered in the drinking water there. John, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, and what surprised me mostly was that the EPA and the government officials did not notify people until approximately 12 to 14 months after the fact. And from what I gather, or from what they're saying, is that this problem was just primarily diagnosed with people who have old lead plumbing and things like that. And we had various water tests done, and you know, mine came back less than 5 because my plumbing is all copper.
Okay.
And then the solder that they used on the plumbing supposedly has less lead in it than it used to. But my question is why, and there have been several EPA people fired here recently because of the fact that they did not promote the notification of the residents of the problem with this water.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my question, is why do they not do that in a timely manner? And how do they get away with that?
That is a great question, John. Eric Olson, John's in Sebring, Ohio. They've got a problem in the drinking water. It's been reported that it was a year or more before the residents were informed of that. What is the law around this? What's the responsibility to inform and respond?
Well, first of all, that's absolutely outrageous as far as I'm concerned. And if officials know that there is widespread lead contamination of water, they are legally required under the Safe Drinking Water Act to notify their customers. So if you're above the action level, for example, the 15 part per billion action level in 10% of the taps that are tested, you are legally required to tell consumers that and to do an education program, tell people if their water that was tested exceed the action level. So that's really unacceptable. And unfortunately, I wish I could say that Flint or Sebring, Ohio, are the only two places in the United States where this is an issue. But unfortunately, it's seeping out that this kind of problem is occurring in many other communities across the country. And frankly, often the officials are sweeping the problem under the rug and are not doing what they should be doing to make sure that people know about it.
I mean, I'm looking here at a chart from the Pennsylvania Department of Health and comparing the blood lead levels in Flint, Michigan, the percent of kids with problems with that, to just Pennsylvania towns. And there are lots of them that have multiples of the Flint level. I'm just going down the list here. Allentown and Scranton and Johnstown and Bethlehem and Wilkes-Barre and Harrisburg, Erie, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh at multiples of the Flint level. And we don't declare a national emergency there. Ray in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi to your guests. I'm really glad you're bringing up this subject right now. We just had the debates here in Milwaukee. It was last Thursday.
I'm sorry, Ray, you cut out for a second. You had what there?
The Democratic debates last Thursday in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That same day, the city of Milwaukee sent out to everybody who lives in a home built before 1951, which I would speculate it's probably 60 to 75% of homes in Milwaukee are older homes, warning us not to drink the water unless we have run the water for at least 3 minutes and we have cleaned out all these filters. Now, the city of Milwaukee, like a lot of big cities across the nation, has had an insane spike in crime, and I'm really glad that you brought the neurological effects to point here, because I would like to see the teenagers that are being locked up in Milwaukee's jails. I mean, it's way out of control what's going on now in the last year. I'd like to see their blood levels tested for lead. These are kids 12 to 17 years old, and I'm willing to bet $1,000 they all have higher levels of lead than what is safe. And our city has known this because of the infrastructure in Milwaukee. We have 100-year-old main water lines that break every winter. Somewhere in the city, you'll have streets flooded, and they always say this water main was 100 years old. And when they try to tell us that those 100-year-old pipes were not made out of lead, somebody in our city government, Tom Barrett, Nick Kovac, my alderman, you name them, they are all criminally suspect in this. And I really wish the federal government would come to Milwaukee and look at our crime is way out of control, and this lead issue in the water.
Ray, let us pick it straight up, and I appreciate your call. Dr. Mazumdar, okay, I'm looking at a Chicago Tribune headline here from last summer saying, studies link childhood lead exposure and violent crime. Is it a fair link? And what about Ray wondering if he's in a city where you've got a whole population that's, in effect, been poisoned in such a way that it would, predestine them toward behavior issues, even crime?
Well, I think it highlights the fact that the burden of lead poisoning falls disproportionately on communities that have many, many other challenges. I think something that hasn't come up in this
Speak more specifically to his question. Mm-hmm. We see that burden. We acknowledge it's more in poor communities. It's more in communities of color, living in older housing stock, less well-maintained. And there's an injustice in that.
Yes.
And Ray is asking, out of that injustice, is it possible that you could have, you know, a generation of kids coming out of that environment who are predisposed to criminal behavior because of that poisoning?
Right. So there are studies that have looked at this directly. And the children who have exposure to lead and criminal behavior. And there are many, or at least a handful of studies that have been able to make that association. So yes, I do think that one of the many neurologic consequences of lead is this. Yes.
That's a pretty big statement right there. Eric Olson, do you see lead levels mapping with crime levels? And it's not, look, we're not trying to, we're trying to look at the whole reality here. Nobody wants to be in an environment where there's high lead level. But what about is there a correlation, Eric?
Yes. Well, there certainly are studies, as you just heard, that make that correlation. I think there are a couple of complications here. One is that if a child is exposed to lead at a young age, they can have that permanent damage, it appears, neurological damage that can cause them to have attention deficits, that can have a variety of problems that can last into teenage years and beyond. Unfortunately, in many cases, you can't just test their lead when 10 years later and find out that that's where the problem might be linked to, because blood lead levels, a lot of that lead actually will deposit in the bones, and it will be remobilized sometimes. I'm sure the doctor could speak to that. Mm-hmm. You can't just do a survey of blood lead levels today and know what might have happened 5 or 10 years ago. Unfortunately, one aspect of this is that this problem is generally invisible. The water doesn't taste any different if it has lead. Often you can't see the lead paint in a way that you would know that it was creating a problem. So really the only solution to this problem is to really invest in our infrastructure, our water infrastructure, to upgrade it, to invest in our housing stock, to clean it up in a safe way so that kids are not being exposed. And that's going to cost money, but frankly, we spend a lot more money on other things that I would argue probably have less benefit to the American public than remedying lead problems across the country.
Maybe including prisons. I mean, here's a little bit from this is Olivia Griffin. A mom lives in West Baltimore. Old apartment, all kinds of things painted there. Big hole in the kitchen ceiling, peeling lead paint on all over the apartment. 3 of her 4 children have dangerously high levels of lead in their blood. Her 1-year-old daughter's level, 5 times the CDC's dangerous level. Here's Olivia in an interview with the Baltimore Sun in December.
The frames in the back bedroom, because that's where my daughter had got her lead paint poisoning from, because of the frame. She's the one that has the level of 25. Her crib is right there. You can see the bite marks. I still don't know what the problems could happen with her still having lead poisoning now, but at that time, I was scared. I just cried.
If that's the environment you've got, what do you do? Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. What are the demographics of this this lead in areas of high income versus low income? And to me, this has been a criminal decision, like in Flint, Michigan. The emergency manager managed to create an emergency, and he and the governor and everybody that backed him should be out there every day delivering water at their own expense to save the taxpayers' money, because they claim to be conservatives. So they created the problem. They need to fix it.
Responsibility, you say. But let's go to that question. Eric Olson, what about the demographics of lead exposure, high versus low income?
Well, clearly it is disproportionately falling. This lead problem is disproportionately falling on low-income communities.
Why?
Especially
Why?
Communities of color. It's a variety of reasons. One is obviously the housing stock issue. If the paint is not intact, if it's older housing that's not as well maintained, often those are going to be in lower-income communities where you have the chipped and peeling paint, where you have the windowsills with the windows going up and down and creating the dust. Lead paint is actually intended to shed dust, which is one reason it lasts so long. That will be shedding into the apartment, into the building. So it is disproportionately there, as well as a lot of the lead service lines are in these older housing areas. The other thing that's really important is that now, as we're seeing more and more areas gentrifying, the older housing, and people are refurbishing these older houses and older apartments, you really have to be careful in dealing with the paint and obviously in dealing with the lead service lines, because you can have higher income people obviously also getting lead poisoned.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, It's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the threat of lead way beyond Flint, Michigan. Lead rates as high and higher in many parts of this country. And what to do about it? You can join us. Why has this not been cleaned up? Can we afford to clean it up? Can we afford not to? And have you seen the consequences up close in your community, your classroom, your family? Andrew Haas is a young boy, lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, was poisoned by lead in the womb. When she was pregnant, his mother, Rebecca, was renovating their home when she realized she was inhaling fumes from lead varnish. Andrew's dealt with delayed speech, neurological damage. Here he is in an interview with the local news site Lancaster Online last year.
In speech class, we, do some activities with our speech, and that, it helped me to, to get my sound, the SH sound out of my mouth, not out of my cheek.
Boy, suffering with it right there, and you can hear it. Plenty of response online. Natalie says, not only does New Orleans have a huge lead problem with substandard housing, lead found in soil and playgrounds, we continue to literally throw lead into the hands of our children. Mardi Gras beads have tested positive for lead. Children play with them all year round, put them in their mouths. Charlie says many cities, especially in the old Rust Belt areas, don't have the industry jobs to support rebuilding their cities. Another casualty of the free trade mantra. G. Welch says, I used to work for a company providing engineering services to our departments in New England. Plenty of old housing stock. Those departments took absolute and deserved pride in delivering the very best quality they could. Sad thing in Flint is that an administrator was put in charge of making a decision that should have been made by an engineer. Yes, there are politics at work all over this problem. Eric Olson is with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Dr. Moitre Mazumdar is with us from Boston Children's Hospital, Harvard Medical School. Gerald Markowitz joins us in just a moment. Aragon is calling from Boston. Aragon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to comment actually on the construction sector. I own a remodeling company in the greater Boston area. We're licensed by the EPA when this first became law in 2010, requiring contractors to register, and then later on Massachusetts picked it up. Now, my comment is about 80 to 85% homes in the Northeast probably have lead in it. I know my home does. And we see this every day. Homeowners are exempt from following the regulations of the EPA's renovate rights rule. Now, one of my neighbors last summer completely stripped their house down with a high-powered sanding equipment. The dust was all over the neighborhood.
Wow.
Now, and they are exempt from this. Now, Boston water lines don't have lead in it, but we have lead in the buildings inside and outside. Homeowners are not aware of what they're dealing with, or the ones that we're aware with don't want to pay for this.
How do you protect yourself and your workers when you're remodeling in that kind of environment, Erwin?
Well, we actually have very specific guidelines for that. They have to wear respirators. They have to wear body suits. They have, we have to designate an exchange area where they get out of this bodysuit, the Tyvek. It's very similar to almost asbestos. I think that's a new level of, a danger that we're dealing with.
But people, homeowners, are not obligated under the law to take those precautions. And you've got a neighbor sandblasting with the dust going all over the neighborhood. Eric Olson, what about regulation of the way this is handled? Is it sufficient?
Now, this is a huge problem. It was quite a fight, I can tell you, just to get the requirements imposed for some renovators. So I'm thrilled that your caller is taking all the precautions that are necessary under the new EPA rules that were more than a decade in the making to get these things out. But it is true that there are exemptions for homeowners. There are other exemptions. It's a big problem, especially if people aren't aware, which very often they are not, of what the risks are to themselves and to their families. We just hear story after story about families you know, where the kids get exposed because the parents are renovating the house themselves, or they bring in a fly-by-night contractor who isn't complying with the lead rules. So it's really important to know whether you've got lead paint when you're doing renovations, especially if you're sanding. And it's very important to also take the proper precautions, bring in the pros in order to avoid getting your family and potentially your neighbors lead poisoned.
Dr. Mazumdar, when you have people come in to your medical practice, let's say kids, of course you'll test them if that's suspected. But can you, if they have serious lead problems, can you see that just by their behavior, by their affect? You've got a lot of experience. Can you come to suspect it? Just
well, you certainly suspect it, and it's one of a long list of things that can cause disruptive behavior or sure. learning problems. Mm-hmm. In Boston, you know, I think we have heightened awareness about the lead levels and the lead issues. But I do think this is an invisible epidemic in a number of different ways. Invisible because you can't. As Mr. Olson, you don't always know you're being exposed, but also invisible in that when children are doing poorly or maybe not as well as they could, lead is often not suspected because people aren't aware that there's lead in their communities.
What about for adults when they're exposed to lead? What are the impacts for adults? We always talk about and hear about children.
Right. So lead is dangerous to everybody, and children are certainly particularly vulnerable because of their growing brains. But the initial recognition of the harmful effects of lead came from studies of adults. If you look at
what occupational kind of implications for an adult?
Well, so there's evidence that lead exposure in adulthood, or it could be accumulated lead exposure over mm-hmm. a lifetime, can lead to accelerated cognitive decline. So
serious for the brain there,
so serious
too,
for just the for brain starters. There too, for high blood pressure, for problems with their kidneys. I think we're only now learning what the long-term effects of our decades-long history of elevated lead and exposure to lead is going to bring to our community.
Xavier in Newport News, Virginia. Xavier, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to speak on the fact you guys talked about demographics for lower income and things like that, having poorly maintained housing. I wanted to bring up, I'm currently in the military.
Okay.
And I've been stationed several places, and there's some of those places have, quote, historical housing. So they just got the inside and they rebuild it on the inside and you move in a house.
Yep.
Well, most recently, my most recent duty station prior to where I'm at now, we had to sign this big piece of paperwork. It was called the lead statement. And it talked about how you guys talked earlier about mm-hmm. running the water for a certain amount of time, not to let your kids dig around the house within 1 foot of the base of the house outside mm-hmm. and just don't play, you know, don't allow the kids to play in the dirt. So it's not just
a good luck problem. With that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not exactly. Not just a problem in necessarily that, you know, lower income or whatever the case is, or poorly maintained. Military housing to this day, they're still having issues with this type of stuff.
Xavier, and, when you were signing that, were you in the back of your mind thinking, "What the heck am I being exposed to here?"
Well, that was my thoughts exactly, and I tried to read into it, and as I thought about it, and it was very vague, and they're very careful to not say too much, but it was really long and in depth, and I really didn't understand what I was, you know, the specifics. I didn't know if that released them from any liability, if I was to run into any issues later on.
It's scary. Xavier, I appreciate your call. I want to bring Gerald Marko. Thank you. I want to bring Gerald Markowitz in, public health historian, professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Graduate Center, City University of New York, co-author of Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children. Gerald Markowitz, you've been studying this for a long time. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom. Nice to be talking to you.
Should we have cleaned this up by this time, or given the ubiquity of lead in our built environment, in pipes, is this beyond our capacity to address?
No, I don't think it's beyond our capacity to address. I mean, lead poisoning is something that is completely preventable. And we as a society have made a choice not to deal with the problem. And I think in large part we've made that choice because disproportionately poor people and children of color are the ones who are affected by this crisis. Although, as your callers and others have said, that it can affect everybody in the society.
If we were going to begin to try and seriously address this, not just in a crisis like in Flint, though that's important, but well beyond that, how would you begin to do it, and what kind of costs are we talking about? How should they be borne?
Well, First thing, when we talk about costs, we always talk about the monetary costs. And we don't talk about the costs in terms of damaged lives and ruined futures for children. But when we talk about the dollar costs, we hear figures of $500 billion, up to $1 trillion to take lead off of the walls of homes across the country. But of course, we don't have to take lead off the walls of every home in the country right now. You can start with those homes that have children who are less than 7 or 8 years old in them, and treat those homes first. And that cost is going to be substantially less than the millions of homes that that where lead currently exists.
If we really address this in a comprehensive way, or as close to it as we could come, what kind of results? I mean, can you picture, like, I don't know, lower crime rates, fewer behavioral problems, higher IQs? Is that too much to imagine? Is it hitting us that broadly?
No, I don't think that's too much to imagine. I think that, as your guests have said, the effects, are in terms of lower school performance, lower IQ, behavioral problems. And I think that children's lives will be substantially improved by getting rid of the lead in their own homes.
Can you see, Eric Olson, that kind of national improvement in quality of life and outcomes if this were comprehensively addressed?
I think absolutely. I mean, that's what the science is showing, is that as blood lead levels go down and exposure goes down, you start to see some of these problems not being associated with the lead. So we can certainly expect that that would be the result. And frankly, we've already probably seen significant benefits of the reduction nationally of blood lead levels on average. But as you know, averages sometimes lie, and we often have outliers. We have some kids that are still getting very high levels of exposure. So we really need to deal with this on a national level.
Abdul Kamil is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Abdul, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to share my story and let people know that it is a national problem. My son contracted a high level of lead poisoning when he was 4 years old, and this was like back in 1994.
What sort of level, Abdul?
46. 46 was the level.
It's high.
So immediately we were contacted by the local health department, and they wanted to hospitalize my son so that they can do chelation therapy to remove the lead.
Chelation, is that like a blood transfusion? Or
it's like a blood transfusion. It's like a blood transfusion where they take the blood out and they take the lead out and then they put it back in. My wife and I, we opted not to do that because we thought that it was too intrusive. And so we got with our naturopathic doctor, Dr. Alan Moskowitz in New Haven, Connecticut, and he helped us get the level down. My wife, she was very much into herbs anyway, so she was doing most of the therapy when she found out what his level was.
How's your son now, Abdul, all these years later?
My son now he's doing excellent. We were concerned about the ADHD and other things that could happen. He's doing well. He'll be 20
6 this year.
Well, we're glad to hear you got around it as well as you could there, and I appreciate your call. Dr. Mazumdar, what about when a child is found to have such an elevated level, what is the standard approach to bringing it down?
Right. So I think the important message is the most important thing to do is to remove the child from a high lead environment to stop the exposure. And then, and certainly we know that if children have poor nutrition, if they're iron deficient, that their absorption of lead increases. And so we try to, if they are iron deficient, increase their iron stores. Mm-hmm. There's some evidence that that's helpful. And then at very high levels, we do try to, take the lead out, though that we don't see that so much anymore. But these are all things after the fact. And I think the most important message is that this is entirely preventable, that there's that treating children after they've been poisoned is really just chasing after the problem and not dealing with the root. If this were polio, and I'll just say that, or meningitis or some other disease that we had a neurologic disease that we knew how to prevent, we would be having a different discussion. But
it's
for
bigger
some,
than polio, but we haven't gone at it with the same vigor. Gerald Markowitz, we're almost out of time here. Mm-hmm. What's your moral message to the country around lead? Moral and practical. We've got half a minute. I apologize.
Well, I think that the moral message is that this is a problem that is fixable, and we as a society have got to make the commitment to do something about it. And if we don't, we are condemning literally hundreds of thousands of children to lives that are less good than they should be.
Gerald Markowitz, professor of history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Thank you so much. Eric Olson at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington. Dr. Moitre Mazumdar from Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Gerald, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Eric Olson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Moitre, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Listeners, take care, be vigilant, and demand the right thing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.